Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Later on, Building Bridges, the Patriot Act and library surveillance. But first, the president's power in war. Will the Supreme Court reassert itself? Donna Newman is counsel to Jose Padilla. In an interview with Mimi Rosenberg, Donna Newman discusses the challenges to the Bush administration's most sweeping claims of national power following the September 11th tragedy. The power to declare any American citizen an enemy combatant and detain him or her indefinitely without trial, and the power to hold him without a chance to challenge the basis of his imprisonment in any court. The Padilla case, which will be heard this spring by the Supreme Court, presents the most direct confrontation between judicial responsibility and executive power in several generations.
Who is Mr. Padilla? What should we know about his case?
Well, Mr. Padilla is a citizen of the United States. He was coming to visit his son in Chicago when he got off a plane, where he was arrested, pursuant to what we call grand jury material witness warrant. Quite a mouthful. But what it really is saying, you, sir, have information that we need to present to the grand jury. And as a result, we are taking you to the grand jury to give that information. People are subpoenaed to the grand jury every day to give information. But when the government says there's a chance that this individual will not appear, will flee, they have a right to have that person arrested for the purpose of putting him before the grand jury. That's why he was arrested in Chicago. And when he came to New York, he was incarcerated. They believed that he would not stay around. And we were fighting that very issue, and motions were pending on that issue, whether or not he can be released. When we were scheduled for a hearing on June 11th, all the briefing had been done, and the president on June 9th, 2 days before the scheduled hearing, issued an executive order as commander-in-chief to have Mr. Padilla seized by the military from his jail cell in New York and taken under the jurisdiction of the military. The president has characterized as an enemy combatant, and he has remained there since June 9th, 2002, and he's been held incommunicado. The government's position essentially is an enemy combatant cannot have access to counsel or any meaningful access to counsel, and that whether or not we hold him indefinitely for the rest of time immemorial is up to us. And the fact that he's an American citizen and no charges are being lodged against him is at our discretion. In short, what they say, that an enemy combatant can be placed in this black hole. He's certainly not in military jurisdiction, no charges are lodged against him. He's not a member of any army. The military has no jurisdiction over him as a result. And they refuse to allow civil court, or the court where he was grand jury material witness warrant was pending, to have jurisdiction over him either. In our opinion, completely a violation of his constitutional rights and very frightening for the rest of the country.
Now, the issues legally that are brought up, one which is certainly the right to counsel, and we should also comment on the category enemy combatant, which I don't believe exists anywhere really in international or national law. If you could enlighten us on these issues.
We need to start at the beginning. Does the president have the authority to detain an American citizen who seized on American soil, not in combat? In other words, did he have the right to seize Mr. Padilla from the Metropolitan Correction Center where he was being detained? We say he does not have the authority under the Constitution. That power is a power that's used on foreign, the zone of combat at least. And in the zone of combat, of course, different rules apply. But where it is a domestic sphere, the commander-in-chief powers are much more diluted. And there is law on this, in which the Supreme Court held this is just not permissible. And in short, this is not the first time that the executive branch tried to flex its muscles in overreaching. And where the Supreme Court has ruled that that, as far as domestically, is not allowed. In addition, Congress, in fact, in the 1970s, had passed a law which prohibited the detention of an American citizen without congressional approval. And by congressional authorization is, you know, some sort of criminal law. You have to be charged with a crime. And if there's any exceptions where the executive wants to detain somebody without charging them with a crime, as here, then they must go to Congress. Even that would be a stretch, I don't think, under the Constitution, anybody can be held without charges. Certainly, under the law, the president, who cannot make law, can only obey the law and carry out the law, cannot do this. And what he's really doing is executive lawmaking, which, of course, is not permitted.
Well, the government brief at one point said that the military detention of enemy combatants in a time of war, including in the current conflict, is absolutely lawful.
They're just wrong.
Okay.
I mean, it's just so simple that they're wrong that it seems absurd for me to say that. But you have to start, first of all, the word enemy combatant or the term, it doesn't exist internationally, and that's what they're relying on. There is belligerence, lawful and unlawful belligerence, and combatants, lawful and unlawful. And perhaps that's what the president should have said. But the reason is because a combatant is a member of an armed forces or a civilian who takes up arms in a zone of combat. And since clearly Mr. Padilla is not alleged to be any one of those terms cannot apply. And so they have now concocted this enemy combatant term. And they say, well, that means anybody who associates with the enemy. And the reason that that's so dangerous, well, the press associates with the enemy. I mean, what do you mean by associated? And that's why it's up to Congress, because Congress defines. And so you can't have this unbridled power. You can't have the executive who defines a crime, who prosecutes a crime, and then is the judge and jury of the crime. And that's what happens here. It is not, as the government says, that from time immemorial. And I can tell you, never, never, never has a citizen been arrested outside the zone of combat. And that has been permitted. Where it has been tried, it has always been rejected. There is one exception, and we hold our heads in shame over that exception. And that, of course, is the Japanese internment camp, which everybody has said has been a total disgrace. In fact, they got, you know, the convictions were overruled in California in the 1980s. They received money for their troubles. And Korematsu, which, interestingly enough, has now filed a brief on behalf of the other enemy's combatant, which is Hanzi. So when I say never, never has it really been done. I mean, the Japanese weren't called enemy combatants, but they might well have been based on what happened to them. And certainly they were held without charges. Same thing has happened here.
I think it's also useful for you to discuss with us some of the context historically of this case and some of the precedent-setting cases, one of which had to do with German spies, which is very telling and very interesting.
The government relies heavily on a case called In re Quirin, and even In re Quirin, as the Second Circuit ruled, it's just not applicable here, and I'm going to tell you why. In re Quirin was a World War II case in which we had declared war. And in the declaration of war, of course, there are articles of war. Congress passes laws that are of significance to the war, you know, to help the president in his fighting of the war and the army in the war. And that's what articles of war do. And during this time, 8 members of the German army landed on our shores in an effort to do reconnaissance, to look for places to detonate bombs and to cause havoc. But one of these saboteurs decides when he lands on the U.S. soil, you know what, I'm not going to participate in this plot. And right away, he goes to the government and tries to tell them about the plot. Well, despite really efforts time and time again to tell them, of course, the FBI ignored him. So he finally goes and gets their attention, and they go and arrest everybody. And they have a military trial. In other words, they charge them with a crime. And the reason Roosevelt determined that they should have a military trial as opposed to a civilian trial was significant. A, the laws at the time would not punish them severely enough, he felt. 2, it would be an embarrassment to the government if the truth about the saboteurs, that is, their effort that they had secretly come into the United States and that this individual's effort to tell the FBI was initially rejected, which showed the incompetence of the FBI. He looked at the Articles of War and found that there was provision that would allow him to have these people tried in the military tribunal. And that's what's important. He looked to the Articles of War, which Congress had passed, which gave him the authority. Well, they had this trial, they were convicted, and they bring this habeas up to the Supreme Court. They've admitted that they were German saboteurs. The issue only was, could they be tried by a military tribunal as opposed to civilian criminal court? And the Supreme Court said yes, and what did they rely on? The Articles of War, a congressional act. Here there is no congressional act. In addition, we have not had a military tribunal. we are not members of a foreign army, and there has been no concession here. So the issues were completely different than the issues that are raised here. The cases are certainly distinct. There is a Civil War case, however, that is much more on point, and that's in Ray Milligan. Milligan and his cohorts were members of an organization, the Sons of Liberty, and their aim was to help the Confederates in every which way, including a plan to kidnap the governor, to get them arms, to release prisoners from the Union jails, Confederate soldiers, and other such mayhem. And they had done mayhem. They were then arrested. They were charged, as Mr. Padilla is alleged to be charged. However, they were charged, there were charges, with violating the law of war. And while Mr. Padilla hasn't been officially charged with anything, that's what the president says he is violating is the law of war. So Milligan and his cohorts go to trial in a military tribunal, and they are again convicted. Milligan brings his case before the Supreme Court as a writ of habeas corpus and says they are holding us illegally in violation of our constitutional rights. And the Supreme Court looks and says, you know what? You're right, Milligan. You are a civilian. This is not a zone of combat. The courts were open and functioning. If you committed a crime, let them charge you as a civilian. The military cannot be civilians on American soil. The government is now saying, well, the whole United States is a zone of combat because of 9/11. The Constitution does not permit the action that is being done here. We have laws. What the government, in its policy of fear, saying that the entire country is in a zone of combat, is just propaganda to frighten us. We are frightened enough. We need to grasp on to our values that has enabled us to be the strong country that we are. And I wonder why, during the Oklahoma City bombing, the entire country was in a zone of combat. At that time, if you recall, we were very frightened of groups which we believed at the time were going to strike again. And nobody said that we could not try the people involved in Oklahoma bombing. And nobody said, like they say here, that they can simply hold Mr. Padilla to interrogate him. And when you hear that, that they just want to hold him to interrogate him, that they have a right to do this, it has to make your blood curdle. It is so contrary to what we believe in this country. It brings us very back to Starr Chambers and to the very reason we have habeas, going back to the writ as it was first established in England. And the reason was the very reason, which is to stop executive detention that is not based on the law.
Donna, in a landmark victory for constitutional protections and the separation of powers in the post-911 era, a panel of the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a 2-1 ruling barring the president from declaring a U.S. citizen an enemy combatant without congressional authorization. Now, in a decision likely to influence another case on enemy combatants before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Federal Appeals Court ordered the government to release U.S. citizen Jose Padilla from military custody in 30 days with the option of transferring Padilla to civilian authorities for a criminal trial. Give us a sense now of what the procedural posture of that case is and the significance of that ruling.
The Hamdi case. Now, Hamdi is an American citizen, but he was seized in Afghanistan. And the courts that have reviewed the Hamdi case and the Padilla case say they are very different. Clearly they are, because the zone of combat cases, which actually the government relies on in saying that they can seize our clients, certainly are just simply not applicable to Padilla, who is seized from the jail. But the Hamdi case is a case that the Supreme Court has agreed to take this term. What the government did is say, if you're going to review Hamdi, you should at the same time review Padilla.
Frightening and exciting at the same time. What has been your communication, if any, at this point, particularly given the alleged opportunity to see Mr. Padilla?
We had filed papers in opposition to the Supreme Court's review, because we are satisfied, obviously, with the Second Circuit ruling. The day that the government's papers would do in reply to our opposition is the day that they made a public announcement that we would be able to see Mr. Padilla. Timing is everything. It's clear to me, based on that they are very concerned with their position that we cannot see him. Now, when I say see him, I'd like to explain that further. The conditions under which they have allowed this are so onerous that it is really a matter of just looking at him, because there really can be no attorney-client communication. They have said, at their discretion, which in and of itself is rather disturbing, the Constitution does not have an asterisk and allow us to see clients at their discretion. But in any event, they say at their discretion, they will allow us to see Mr. Padilla, provided, A, all our conversations with him are recorded in videotape, 2, there is in the room a member of the military who can take notes. All our notes must be handed in to the military for their review. And whatever we give Mr. Padilla must be given to the military for their review. So this is not an attorney-client meeting. This is a meeting to look at him and to say that we are working for him, and this is whatever is a matter of public record. But we certainly cannot question him about anything. That includes his conditions under which he is being housed, because they will also limit the areas of discussion.
Well, after a year and a half of physical isolation, actually 18 months of physical isolation and legal abandonment, obviously it's time that Mr. Padilla had his day in court. If the government has enough evidence, why haven't they actually formally charged Mr. Padilla, and why are they so adamantly opposed to presenting the case before a judge?
I have no idea why they fear the court, but they do. Everything they have done is to avoid having a judicial body make a meaningful decision. Their arguments are constantly that the court must bow to the executive determination, which is not true as far as the law provides. They are running from the court. I believe they, you know, you run from a court when you fear them because you don't like what result you think they will have. And in addition, how easy is it that you simply grab a citizen, you can interrogate him in secret, and then throw him to the wolves? Isn't that a great country? It certainly makes their life easy, because in court, you have to own up to the court. You have to present your evidence. You cannot have free reign.
Well, Donna Newman, we wish you well. We will follow this case closely. It is of tremendous importance for our democracy, our civil liberties, and we are very pleased to have had the opportunity to speak with you.
Ken, you've been to the library. What did you get?
1984 by George Orwell. I figure if we're moving in the direction of Big Brother watching everything we do, I may as well see where we'll end up.
Well, you'd better be careful the government doesn't know what you're reading, Ken.
Well, with the ease that the government can now surveil our library usage, not to mention any number of other activities, I'm sure they'll know what we're all reading and writing, talking about, and buying and selling.
The American Civil Liberties Union, amongst other groups, has come out strongly against their surveillance that the government is practicing in libraries, internet usage, commercial transactions, and a host of other areas.
As has the American Library Association.
Let's now hear from Maurice Friedman, director of the Westchester Library Association and former president of the American Library Association.
There's two amendments to the U.S. Constitution that we want to take very seriously and have a great deal to do with library use, the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. The First Amendment basically guarantees you could read whatever you want, say whatever you want, hang out with whomever you want, except if you're in the process of urging people to commit a crime that's very real and present. Basically, you can say and associate with whomever you please and read whatever you please. And the Fourth Amendment says nobody can interfere with what you own, can't come into your house, get records about you, can't get information about you without some kind of demonstration of probable cause. And libraries have honored that. But we've got to give up the records if there's a properly executed subpoena. Virtually every state in the union has a law that says for people to get the circulation records, what I took out of the library, the police, the law enforcement people have to show up, demonstrate to a judge probable cause that interfering with my privacy is going to help them solve a crime or keep a crime from being committed. And the librarian can fight that subpoena. They also can tell the person whose records are being searched. They can tell the press. They can tell anybody they want that there's a subpoena for Mitch Friedman's records. The Patriot Act changes all of that. The First Amendment out the window, the Fourth Amendment out the window. What happened with the Patriot Act is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was redefined or rewritten or amended so that if the FBI wants Mitch Friedman's records, they go to a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. And they've got this tremendous responsibility of documentation to get an order that says the library has to comply. What they've got to demonstrate, what they actually say to the judges in this court is, we need this information because it's pursuant to a terrorist investigation. That's it. So there's no probable cause. No further information is disclosed because the information is classified and the judges aren't qualified to hear the classified information. Can a judge say no? No, under the law, if the FBI asks for it, they have to give him the court order. So when Ashcroft talks about a judicial process for executing one of these orders, that they just can't go willy-nilly and get one, yes, there is a judicial process. The FBI actually has to ask for the order. The absolute answer is always yes. Because of that, if the librarian wants to tell the press they're coming for Mitch Friedman's records, they're committing a felony. If they want to tell Mitch Friedman they're coming after my records, it's a felony. If they want to tell anybody other than an attorney who they're consulting about it or someone else on the library staff who's necessary so they can get the records out of the computer, then it's not a felony. It's changed everything completely. It redefined the terms of library use. Privacy and confidentiality have always been a concern of libraries and something we've defended and tried to stand up for in terms of people's rights and uses of the library. Privacy, when people have a reference question, we don't ask their name. We don't keep records about what they asked, what they want, unless they need us to get back to them later. But we don't keep records of that. That's what our privacy is guaranteed. Confidentiality is where we have to keep records because we got a responsibility for the books and CDs and everything else there. So we keep records, but the online systems that libraries have everywhere except in Bergen County, those library systems abolish or get rid of the connection between what you took out and your name after you return the book. In Bergen County, they keep that for 2 years. Westchester Library System, where I am, it's 3 weeks. Because of the backup system, it's 3 weeks. We make the break right away, but we keep tapes for 3 weeks, so in case automation falls apart. Anyway, the point is, we have a history of only keeping what we need to maintain the library and run it. So we're against the Patriot Act, we fought it, and we keep fighting it because the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom to read, the right to read, are precious to librarians and library workers everywhere. And we will do everything we can to protect our users' confidentiality. But they stuck us with felonies if we open our mouths, and that's the story. Thank you very much.
Now, to put library surveillance in a wider context of increased attacks on privacy rights by the Bush administration without any effective judicial review, we have Udi Ofer, Project Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
The primary way that judicial oversight has been eroded is through the expansion of the secret court that meets in Washington, where all proceedings are closed off, a court that almost never issues a public opinion, and where there's one party to all proceedings, and that's the government. This is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, created in 1978 to deal with cases of foreign intelligence. The argument was, if the United States government wants to wiretap someone working in the Soviet embassy, it shouldn't have to go through regular federal district court. Well, what the Patriot Act did was that it expanded the jurisdiction of this court dramatically, where now it's dealing with cases that have nothing to do with terrorism or foreign intelligence and that affect your rights. And one of the main ways that it does that is through Section 215. And that's the provision that allows the government to obtain records, and it's not only library records. It's any tangible thing. And actually, Attorney General Ashcroft boasted over the summer during Senate Judiciary Committee hearings that it could even mean your genetic information. The definition of any tangible thing could not be obtained by the government without having to prove criminal suspicion. You've seen a huge, huge erosion of privacy rights in the United States. Unfettered government access to personal records, surveillance of internet activity, what websites you've logged on to, who have you been sending emails. They don't have to prove criminal suspicion. You see this in other programs, Total Information Awareness Program. That's when the government wanted to obtain information on all U.S. citizens at all times. Right now, if you dissent, if you criticize American foreign policy or domestic policy, you're considered unpatriotic. Well, that's wrong. So what are we doing about it? In New York City, we introduced Resolution 909. It's a resolution that calls on the government officials to uphold civil rights and civil liberties when undertaking anti-terrorism initiatives. 3 states and over 215 cities, towns, and villages across the country have already passed these resolutions, representing over 27 million people. The state of Alaska, where the legislature is controlled by Republicans, both chambers, passed one of the most progressive resolutions in the country. This is becoming more and more of a nonpartisan issue. Thank you.
This has been a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special.